Thank you, JD. It's good to see all of you here this afternoon. It's my first time visiting Columbus, Indiana. So in this part of Indiana, I haven't come by. My wife is from Kentucky, so I've been to Louisville and southern Indiana. But this part is something I have not come by. It's really nice, beautiful. It was a wonderful drive coming here from Cleveland. So when JD first approached me and said, you know, we'd like you to come here and give a talk about aspects of evidences to believe in God, and so I was like, well, how do I go about doing this, right? Many of us already have some element of faith that we share. I know majority here, we share the same faith, but somebody who doesn't share that faith, you know, how do we approach that person and convince them or even start a conversation about it? And so I thought probably the best way to do it is to share with you as I went through my journey trying to figure out believing in God, trying to figure out what's the right way to approach God and the questions about faith, etc. And that might help you and rekindle in your own minds the path that each of you took. And sometimes it's good for us to go back to where we started, to know what the reasons we believed and why we made that step and we took that step, even unto baptism eventually, and that will rekindle our faith as well, ourselves, if we have grown weaker over time. But also, it will help us communicate better that path that we have taken. So I'll share with you as we go along what path I took, and we can go from there. So I'll tell you a little bit about my background as we go along, and I'll share with you my story as well. And hopefully that'll be helpful as we go along. So the reason I titled this Conflict of Religious Beliefs and is Atheism the Answer is really because that's what triggered me down this path as well. You know, so I will tell you, share with you aspects of how we all typically, or most people, come to their faith of their adulthood, right? We all go through a path, and many of those paths are very different from each other, but we all tend to follow certain patterns, and I'll share that pattern with you initially. And then talk a little bit about how atheism has been projected to be the counterpoint or the solution to religious conflict that we do see in this world. Right, and so the question then becomes, well, is it the best answer or not? And so we'll talk a little bit about at the end of this first lesson, at least, atheism versus theism, and how do they really compare in explaining what we see around us, right? So so much of this first lesson will be about some philosophical aspects of things. Lesson two is much more biblical, biblically focused. Right now, we're just setting up the stage so that we understand, well, do we even want to read this book, the Bible? You know, why would I pick it up? I really want to potentiate that step and critically ask, you know, is it worth picking up or not? And so we need to come there. So that's what we're going to talk initially about. So how do we typically choose our faith, right? If you think about our own lives, from childhood to adolescence to adulthood, there are things that we do, right? So if you think about childhood, in our childhood, usually we adopt the faith of our parents or the culture that we grew up in. That's really what most children do, right? Parents teach them what they believe is right and what they out there, the family believes is right, and then the culture around them that believes is right is what children typically start off with, and we all do that way, and that's just human nature. That's how we start, right? So we're not born with this broad intellect to figure out everything. We are not. We grow into that as we do. So as we grow from childhood, right, we come to adolescence, and this is where we start exploring, we start thinking about things. We say, well, we meet other people who are not probably from our own family or our cultural backgrounds, right? They challenge us and we explore, or they share with us their experiences. So we explore and then we question. We rebel, you know, this is part of what we do, right? We do that as well, we rebel. And then come back, return, and we go through the cycle over and over again through our adolescence. This is very typical, right? So it's not, and even those of us who have grown up in a faith and secured ourselves within that faith over our lifetime have gone through this process, even if it's not externally, internally in our minds, right? And it's not necessarily an unhealthy process. It can be a healthy process. The rebellion part, well, I wouldn't say that's healthy, okay? So let's not go down that path, but at least the exploration and questioning is healthy. We need to know why we believe and what is the basis for our belief. And if we don't do that, we will always assume what we grew up as children is right, and someday we might be challenged in a way that goes beyond our ability to answer, and that could be a crisis. So we don't want it to lead to a crisis of faith. We want to build up and think about it as we grow along. And that's what we all do, right? And then through that process, by the time you come to adulthood, one of three things broadly can happen, right? You end up in some strong faith and you say, well, this is, I'm secure in my faith. This is what I'm going to do all the rest of my life. I'm going to stick to this. And I find the right support group and I stick to it. That's one option, right? The other option is a relatively weaker option when it comes to adherence, right? It's a cultural adherence or ceremonial adherence to faith, right? So this is what much of the world does, right? Most folks will say, well, I'm a Hindu or I'm a Muslim, I'm a Catholic, and they observe it a few times a year. They observe the festivals and they are part of the community. The broader community, and then they want to be part of that, and there's not necessarily a deep adherence to all the tenets of what that faith is. We ignore some of the more difficult requirements and we focus on the easy ones and just go along, right? Because a lot of people do that. And then the third option is complete rejection and say, well, this is all something that is completely not true, and I'm going to do something completely different in my life, and I'll never think about questions of religion at all and go about my life that way. There are people who do that. So, but having said that, we all probably all don't always fall into one of these three groups. We kind of probably sometimes vacillate between them. In our own lives, we might have time periods when we are very strong in our faith, right? And then, we get weakened for whatever reasons. Things are going on in my life. I have distractions, struggles, and I kind of fall into the middle ground there. And then, or sometimes I fall away, and then I come back. So this cycle of exploration, rebellion, return that very strikingly happens typically in adolescence can also happen in adulthood, and it's not unheard of, right? And so that's just something to think about. But what I'd like to share with you is really some things that could happen in our lives, and I've kind of used these lightning rod kind of things there. These are strong events that can happen in our lives, right? These are events in our family, events in our personal lives, events around us that can jar us, right? And we, even though we are secure in our faith, we come to this jarring reality that we see, and we ask the question, well, yeah, you know, I thought always that people I loved and everything they all thought one way, and then this event happened and I realized somebody's true colors come out, and in the times of crisis, how we react to it individually as groups, as faith communities or as communities, political communities, right? Those can be jarring events. And you might think in your own time frame, in your lifestyle, in your lifetime, periods in your life where these events happen, and they may not have happened in your personal life. They may have happened hundreds of thousands of miles away, and they affected you very strongly, and they affected people around you very strongly. And that may have led to somebody saying, "You know what? I'm walking away. I'm not coming back here again." You know, and those things do happen. So, considering that those events might happen, right? And by the way, if you think about, we'll jump a little bit ahead, you know, this is not a new phenomenon. This is a phenomenon that's been happening from day one. Jesus himself talked about it. He said, there will be persecution, there will be temptation. You know, it's not that your life is going to be devoid of that, but it's a question of how do you step up to that and how do you handle that, right? So we need to be prepared, no matter which way we go, whatever we choose, we need to be prepared for the questions that will arise because of events in our lives, right? In our own minds, right? So how do we get there, right? So I think my perspective is that we always need to test the foundational principles of whatever we believe in. We've got to figure out why we believe what we believe, test those foundations, check to see whether they are strong, and go where the data takes you, right? It might be that the childhood faith that I grew up in may not be able to, the foundations may not be strong enough. When I tested them, they were weaker than I expected them to be. Then I may have to choose and go searching and figure out what to do next. That happens, and that happened in my life, and so that might happen in others as well. And I'm saying this, you know, coming from a person who was raised in the Hindu faith, you know, and who has ended up somewhere else, but it might happen to a person who was raised in the Christian faith who ends up somewhere else. So it doesn't matter. We all need to do the same process. We all need to test the foundations of our faith. If we don't test it, we are walking blindly. We need to walk with a certain amount of evidence, at least. You know, how much evidence we can gather, that's a question that we will talk about as we go along. But as much evidence as possible, we need to gather it, digest it in our minds, secure it in our hearts, and then help that lead to the next step in our lives, whatever that may be. Right? Because we don't want to be what most of us sometimes fall into and be just get comfortable where we are. Right, and just fall into that pattern, whatever that pattern is, if it's going to church or if it's going to not going to church, whatever it is, right? The pattern, being comfortable in that pattern can cause trouble, okay? So we need to get comfortable, get secure in that, in the choice that we make, as opposed to just fall into that pattern and get comfortable there. And that's really what the challenge is that we will be talking about today. How do we test this, and how do we go down that path, right? So having said that, you know, so I started off, and I can tell you, I'll share a little bit about my background. I come from a country called India, right? It's a very large, it's a billion people strong now, very diverse country. There are lots of different religions. It's a secular democracy. It was one of the oldest nations in that region. Civilization has been there for thousands of years. And as different people have come through that region, they have brought with them different ideas, and those ideas have settled into this area, and they have grown up into communities that are pretty strong and diverse. If you think in terms of the current day distribution of religious, gender religious allegiances that people might ascribe to, about 80% is in a broad scale called Hindu. They conform to a broad set of traditions called Hinduism. It's not a religion, it's just a set of traditions. Islam is another one, it's about 20 or 15% or so. And then you have Christianity, the broader Christianity that you might think about 3% or so, and a bunch of other ones as well. So it's a very diverse nation, a lot of different communities living very close to each other, with each other, beside each other, right? And that has led to different subcultures within each of these broad religions. Subcultures of syncretism, where they bring together ideas from different religions, put them together and follow it jointly. Or there are subcultures of atheism as well in different parts. You know, parts of Buddhist believers or people who follow Buddhism follow an atheistic version of Buddhism, and you might wonder how is that even possible. We can talk about that later on. So there are a lot of different things, and even within Hinduism, it's not a monolith. As I said, it's a very broad set of culture traditions. There too, there are different streams. People who might ascribe to different views, philosophical views of reality and what it means to be an individual. What does a soul mean? What does God mean? People have a lot of different ideas, okay? And so you got a lot of mix of different ideas all together in one place. Well, what's going to happen, right? Sometimes folks get passionate about what they are talking about, and that passion boils over into action, and action can be at times pretty violent. And And that's sad. It's sad because it leads to a lot of unnecessary conflict and unnecessary violence, and it leads to people making preconceived notions about people from different faiths, right? There are a lot of things that happen there, and it's just purely emotional, on emotional grounds, right? There with some potential personal histories mixed in. So that was just the reality, and India tends to continue doing that, and there are a lot of faith communities there, and those conflicts occasionally do arise. In fact, when the British left India in 1947, one of the people in the British Parliament said, well, that country's never going to stay together. There are just too many people, too many different kinds of people there. They're going to break apart, right? It was predicted not to be a country in 1947. Now, no, almost several decades later, and we are still fine. So I'm still a citizen of India, although I live here in the United States, so I can say we when it comes to India still. But here's the crisis that happened in my own faith. So I grew up in the Hindu tradition. I was part of the a priestly caste, a Brahmin community, very, very, very focused on religious tradition. So my ancestors and my immediate family were very devout Hindus. My mom still is a very devout Hindu. Nonetheless, they were all highly educated people as well, and so they were all educated, nonetheless also very devout, and held on to their faiths. And 1992, when I was in high school, middle school, high school, around that time, there were quite a bit of conflicts. Okay, I grew up in a city called Secunderabad or Hyderabad, right down here in the southern part of India. They used to, growing up as a child, there used to be Hindu-Muslim riots every year. It was a cycle that we just knew. Well, okay, it's a Hindu festival, all right, there's going to be a riot, there's going to be a curfew tonight because there's going to be a riot somewhere. Somebody's going to do something stupid, and then people are going to get riled up, and there's going to be a curfew, right? And then it's a Muslim festival, same thing happens. Somebody does something stupid, right? Or basically they use the excuse to get rid of personal vendettas, clean it up, right? And then the riot begins, and a lot of people jump in to just clean up what they wanted to do in the first place anyways. And then because the government doesn't know who's doing what for what reason, they just say religious riots, curfew. And 3-4 days later on, everybody's fine, right? We all go back to our lives. You're all cool. Oh, yeah, everybody's happy. And we get back to life. And that's just the way it was. Until in the early 90s, there was this very strong nationalist political movement, a Hindu nationalist movement that came along and stoked a lot of resentments that were there from the time of independence, when India and Pakistan were separated into two countries. There were a lot of resentments that are there that are still not completely addressed. So because of that, what happened is a whole bunch of Hindus got together. And there was this one place, this is 14th century mosque or monument, a historical monument. It's called Babri Masjid. They all got together and they broke that thing down, and they wanted to build a temple there because the assumption was that sometime in history, in the 14th century, Muslim invaders came through, and there was a temple that stood there in honor of one of the deities of Hinduism, Rama. And the temple to his in his name was broken down, and a mosque was built there. So they wanted to correct that historical event, and they said, well, we'll break down the mosque, and now build a temple. Well, it doesn't work so easily, right? So a lot of people got riled up. There were religious riots, and there were very strong divisions, and I was surprised as a kid at the time, growing up in a Hindu family, where the refrain in my family was always, well, we are Hindus, we believe all paths lead to God. There is no problem. You can worship your God any way you want, any place you want. You'll be fine. And nonetheless, having said that, some of my family members were involved in that political process that led to the destruction of a national monument. Right? It was a nationally protected monument, and it was still broken down and destroyed. And that was a major jarring event in my mind at that point in time as a kid. So I had already, you know, here I'm a kid, and I was very steeped in my religion. I really was studying the scriptures, the Hindu scriptures at that time. I was very, very interested. And then this happens, and I had good close friends that I grew up with who were Muslim, and they were heartbroken, and you know, it's just you add up all of those emotions, right? And so I was like, you know what? None of this makes any sense. We're killing each other over something stupid. It's all just human traditions. These are all just men talking about what they want to believe and masquerading as edicts from God. So I said, well, what's the right answer? There is no God. And that was my emotional reaction to a major event that transpired in my life and I grew up around. Now, you might state, well, that was a pretty big jump, Vinay. And I'm like, well, maybe. But I was a kid, and I was trying to make sense of what's going on, and I just could not. And I said, well, what I grew up stating in my household, saying all paths lead to God, and you can worship God anywhere you want, if that's truly what we believe, why should we care about a building and destroy it just to build a temple? It makes no sense to me, right? So I just did not make any sense. I couldn't fit those two facts in my head together. So I said, I threw it all out, and I said, well, you know, let me start from scratch. There is no God. All we're just fighting over, you said, I said, here's what I think, here's what you think, and that's all we're fighting, and we're going to keep fighting. If we keep doing this, there's no point. We're just going to be dragging each other to the floor without any fundamental reason to do that. So that was where my path into atheism began. And of course, you know, you'll search for something, you'll find what you want, right? That's just the way the world is, right? So I jumped right into, and I was also very much interested in science and mathematics and understanding the basis of logic, etc. At that time, growing up as a kid, going into college, this was my interest as well. But so I became an avowed atheist, saying, well, none of this makes any sense. So I steeped myself in literature supporting my idea. Bertrand Russell was a famous philosopher, and he's written many books about logic, about mathematics, the basis of mathematics, basis of logic, basis of philosophy as well, metaphysics as well. And Bertrand Russell was an atheist as well, an avowed, I shouldn't say atheist, an agnostic. Now, most people who say they're atheists, they're basically speaking out as atheists, but largely they just say, well, I don't know if there's a God. And that's, you know, most folks would when pushed, would say, well, I'm agnostic. I would, you know, holding on to the extreme atheist position is relatively rare, okay? But nonetheless, Bertrand Russell was one who was a vowed agnostic, but spoke up as an atheist at times. And he spoke up against religion, and I have this quote here. Religion is based mainly upon fear. Fear of the mysterious, fear of defeat, fear of death. Fear is the parent of cruelty, and therefore it is no wonder if cruelty and religion have gone hand in hand. My own view on religion is that I regard it as a disease born of fear and as a source of untold misery to the human race. And so Bertrand Russell, you know, he was pretty firm in his speech about that. And this is a perspective you will hear more in modern times as well. Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, there have been these highly vocal opponents to religion, and they have spoken up against religion and how it needs to be quelled if reason needs to survive, or if humanity even needs to survive. So there are a lot of polemical statements. Here's one from Richard Dawkins. It is fashionable to wax apocalyptic about the threat to humanity posed by the AIDS virus, mad cow disease, and many others. But I think a case can be made that faith is one of the world's great evils, comparable to the smallpox virus, but harder to eradicate. It's a perspective that you would hear. And there are people who believe this very strongly, and the question then would be, well, okay, how do we have a reasonable conversation about it? Because you can't just say, well, you know, you're going to hell, I'm going to walk out from there. It doesn't work that way, right? We're not to do that. At the same time, it also, from if you're a person who is of this perspective, or not necessarily this complete perspective, but saying, well, I'm questioning the value of religion, or different faiths, or whatever the faith is. When they put all religions together as one box, right? We recognize that all religions are not the same. There are differences there, just like all atheists are not the same. There are differences there, right? So we tend to put people in boxes, and that's just how humans are. We need to tease it out, right? Figure out, you know, what exactly do you mean by religion? You know, what is really bad about religion versus what is good? You know, are there examples of goodness that comes out of religious traditions? Yes, there are innumerable ones, right? Across, we can rattle off from our fingers a whole bunch, but we don't need to now. But this is where I was, and I strongly believed in at the time that not assuming or presuming the existence of God is actually a better way to lead one's life, because then you can just focus on what you can measure, focus on the evidence around you, and follow it as it goes along. So you don't need all these religious structures on top of your head to guide what you have to do. As a kid, it also helped me that I didn't have to follow any rules. I was like, yeah, you know, it works out both ways, right? So how much of it was because I didn't want there to be rules as opposed to the jarring events, I don't know. Right, so probably a mixture of both, but nonetheless, this is where I was, and I really firmly believed in Bertrand Russell's writings, and he was very strong influence in my life at the time, and he was also strongly influencing other aspects of my growth in physics, in mathematics, and in my pursuit of science as a career as well. I learned quite a bit, so just quite a bit I learned from there. But having said that, very quickly, this is 1992, 1994, 1995, joined college, right? I started really asking questions about the nature of reality, the nature of the universe. You know, what does it mean to have consciousness? What is consciousness? What is life? You know, what's the basis of life? How do we understand the origin of life? How do we understand the origin of the universe? Right? When you start thinking about these questions, you start wondering, we need answers, right? Of course, religions have had these answers from a long time. Yeah, God created everything. God's the author of everything, and that's it, right? So it's been but from this side, if you don't accept the answers from theism and religion or faiths, right, you need to answer some questions as an atheist. And those questions are standard ones that many of you might know, but we'll go through them, right? First of all, why is there something instead of nothing, right? This is a very fundamental question. This was asked many, many centuries ago, millennia ago, by the Greek philosophers, right? It's not been completely, fully understood as yet. And for the long time, you know, the early 19th century, even physicists believed strongly that the universe was eternal, that there was no beginning per se to the universe as a whole. And then there were measurements made, you know, people were looking at there were models in physics that came along, and then the current consensus is that there was a Big Bang, and that there was a definite starting point to the universe as we see it. Okay, so if you think in terms of the old ways of thinking, where many scientists believed, even Einstein for a good period of time thought that the universe was constant, eternal, had no beginning, had no end, and so it's fine, they could easily say, well, there is no beginning to the universe, why are we even bothered about that question, who created it? It's always been there. And so and their answer back was, well, if you are saying, well, there is a God and God created this, but God is eternal, God never had a beginning, God's a self-sufficient being, a necessary being, as opposed to what they would call contingent being, contingent or something else, right? we can say that the universe itself is a contingent or necessary being. They were like, the universe is our God, the universe has been there forever, and so we don't have to worry about this problem. So don't bother us with this philosophical question of who created or why is there something. It's not a meaningful question. And Bertrand Russell had a very, very strong discussion, and there was a debate with F.C. Copleston where he points out repeatedly that asking the question of what caused the beginning of the universe is not necessarily a meaningful question in its first place. And he said, well, it's, and further on he said, well, fine, let's assume that everything has a cause and everything that we know has a cause, and so we look at the causes cause and the causes cause and keep going back up as you keep going to this series of causes. He's like, well, why not take it all the way to infinity and all we have is a series of causes? And he was like, he felt that it was perfectly fine to suppose an infinity of causes as opposed to asking, is there a first cause? And which is what, which is how you would get to the point of what caused that first cause and, you know, what is that? What's the source of that? So Russell was very adamant that it didn't make sense to talk about causes and series of causes. But there has been, when I first came across that itself was like, that's a weak argument, okay? So to say, well, it's an infinity of causes, go away, you know? I don't want to talk about it. This is how it felt like. It felt like a flippant argument to say, you know, I'm not interested in going down this path with you. But let's say it's not a flippant argument, and then you ask the question, well, how do we understand that? Modern science has come to perceive that the universe was not infinite, was not always present. There is some growth phase. And if you start working it backwards, the current models of cosmology suggest that there was a point in time where the universe came to existence. Now, you know, then the question then becomes, well, what happened before that? And so Stephen Hawking, in his Brief History of Time, he was saying, well, there is no question of what happened before that because time itself had a beginning at the beginning of the universe. So the current models of cosmology say time and space had a beginning. So then the question becomes, well, there's no point asking what happened before because there is no before. There is nothing before time. Well, what do you mean by before? There is nothing there. So nonetheless, the fact that something started tells you that it started from nothing. And so then how does that happen? There is no current understanding as to how that might happen. There are some speculations, of course. Copleston had a really nice comeback to Bertrand Russell, and I think it was pretty striking to me even then as a kid. He's like, well, even if you consider this infinity of causes, right? He says a series of events is either caused or it's not caused, right? It's a simple thing, right? Either it's caused or not caused. Simple idea. If it's caused, there must be something, there must obviously be a cause outside that series. You're looking at a series of events and you're saying, well, there's a cause to all of this, that cause should be outside those series. If it's not caused, whatever that is that's outside those series, is not caused by itself, then it is sufficient to itself, right? If that first cause that caused this, or that cause that caused this series of events to happen, is sufficient to itself. If it is sufficient to itself, it is what I call necessary, and basically that's what he said is by definition God. Okay, so from Copleston's standpoint, the theistic definition of God was just something that's outside all the stuff that you see going on in the universe, right? Like everything that you measure, everything that's happening that you can say happened or is going to happen or is happening, right? You take all of that, you add it together and say these are all the series of stuff that's happening there. You step back and say, well, what caused all of that to happen, right? And that is basically what he claims to be God. Now, and we can take that with a grain of salt, but it's there, right? The next question, there are more other questions as well that come along and say, well, why is there order rather than chaos, right? We say, why is there something rather than nothing? But then even if there is something, why is it not chaotic, completely disorderly? The very fact that we can comprehend the universe is pretty fascinating. And John Lennox is a mathematician, modern-day philosopher, and also an apologetic. He was like, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is the fact that it is comprehensible in the first place. It doesn't have to be. We don't need to live in a universe that is orderly. Doesn't, why should there have been order? You could have just all been chaotic, nothing could ever have come out of it. Why did they have to be life? Why did they have to be humans? Nothing. There's no necessary requirement from our current understanding of the laws of physics that all of this had to happen. It could have just been nothing, right? So that was a question that had to be asked and had to be answered by atheists, right? And where is that order coming from? And more recently, there's been a lot of understandings about the universe itself and how the fundamental constants of the universe, about the size of the atoms, the size of the electrons, the neutrons, the protons, the constants, the gravitational constants. If you take all of these so-called fundamental measurements that are underlying the laws of physics that we know of as of now, right? All of those numbers that we have measured and we have figured out seem to be exquisitely fine-tuned to support life. If you change a small number here or there, very quickly you will see that, well, stars wouldn't be born, and then therefore there wouldn't be any carbon life forms, so there would not be life, as we know it at least, right? We don't know what else would not happen, we're not sure. But at least what we can measure, what we know, it appears that all the laws of physics, chemistry, etc., fundamental things of dead matter, right? Not of life. I'm not talking about biology here. I'm talking about dead matter stuff, right? So physics, chemistry, stuff that you and I would not call living. All of those laws that govern those dead matter are finely tuned so that living matter can exist. The question is how, right? Why, right? How is that possible? So one answer to that is, well, you know, Vinay, you're just going in circles. If the universe were anything else, we merely wouldn't be here talking about it. That's one way of stating the answer, reply back. It's called the anthropic principle. There are different versions of it. Another way of stating the anthropic principle, at least the hard one, is the universe is as it is because we are as we are. But that's not satisfactory. You and I know that, right? We recognize that. It's obvious that it's not an explanation. It's just a statement of restatement of facts in a slightly folksy way, right? The universe is as it is because we are as we are. It sounds nice, but it doesn't explain anything, right? So the other options are more recent ones. People have talked about an infinite number of universes, and this is coming from mathematical frameworks that are trying to explain or trying to unify physics at the quantum scale, at the subatomic scale, with the physics that happens at the scale of very, very large distances and, you know, at relativity and gravity. And so you have string theory and other theories that are being put together. And those mathematical frameworks, which is what they are mathematical frameworks that are trying to tie together a lot of these different things. Those frameworks suggest that they could be, if you tinker with the parameters, you get an infinite numbers of types of universes. We just happen to be in the one that supports life. Now, well, that's fine. You can state that, but that's not an explanation either, right? It's just a hypothesis. Because in principle, we cannot measure any of the other universes. It's not possible. And the theory itself will tell you that. Oh, you know, don't try to go about measuring the other universes. It's not going to happen, because information will not flow between universes. Well, then you're telling me that I can't measure something, I can't test it, so I cannot test the basic presumption of this approach that says there are multiple or infinite numbers of universes. Then it's not science anymore, right? It's just another philosophical construct. And that's fine, and that's what it is, right? So that is not satisfactory, right? Most important is, these questions are, in principle, not answerable by science alone. And that's really the bottom line, right? So it's not that we can't conceive of these things. We certainly can. We talk about them, right? Physicists, philosophers can conceive of these things. But science is about what can you test. You can conceive, I can conceive a lot of things. I can conceive of the tooth fairy, right? It's perfectly fine. Well, how do you test that, right? So you got to figure it out. So the problem is, answering these questions from a scientific basis is very hard to do, or it's actually impossible to do. So if it's impossible from science, then we're back to philosophy and we're back to other questions. You know, how do we explain all of this? And what do we do? And atheistic standpoint has no explanation that is satisfactory. And that's really where I ended up in by when I was around 2000 or so, is what I considered. I was like, well, I'm just not satisfied. It's not working out, right? And then you add on top of that, Bertrand Russell again, my favorite author, all right? He says, well, then, yeah, that's all true and fine. More importantly, he says, his belief, and this was a nice little summary of his own belief in his own words, he said, man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. And then he ends with, only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. This was a tipping point for me, right? This, I was like, well, if I'm holding on to this philosophy that says, well, I can't explain anything about where you came from, and I can't tell you anything about the purpose of your life, it just exists and it just goes away. Not only can it not provide the explanations about the big questions, about where we all come from, where the universe come from, why is there order, and all of those questions that we just talked about, it can't even provide answers for me individually as to what my purpose is. So for me, it was defunct both from an intellectual perspective and also from an emotional perspective, right? So and those are key, you know. Emotion is not something that we throw out of the door. Emotion is part of who we are, and we need to recognize that as conscious beings, and we need to work with that. It just did not fit, right? If it does not fit, then the question is, what do I do? And I was like, back to square one. I said, this is not right. So I start searching again, right? Because this was no longer satisfactory, no longer helpful in explaining everything, and no longer fundamentally preventing the very kinds of emotional angst that leads to violence that caused me to run away from religion in the first place. So if it is not, then what's the point, right? I'm holding on to something that is really it's ashes. That's what I'm holding on to, right? And it's not helping. So that was an awakening, or rather rude awakening at that time. Of course, these are, this is not just me, you know, modern atheist philosophers have also talked about how the fundamental questions about the origin of life or the origin of consciousness cannot be answered by our current materialistic reductionist scientific paradigm. So there are a lot of tedious things that people have been talking about more recently. Thomas Nagel is a philosopher. He's an atheist, right? He does not believe in theism, but nonetheless, he has seriously questioned the paradigm that we have built. And this is a book that came out a few years ago, Mind and Cosmos, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. He wrote it in a very, very strong way. But he has raised serious questions which are very similar to what I just talked to you about, right? And he has formulated this in a very, very technical way in the philosophical side. Here's one that you may have come across, Anthony Flew, right? He was a notorious atheist for many, many years, very polemical, very outspoken against religion, and then he changed his mind as well. And his reason was based on what we know from science, not because of science he walked away from religion, but he said, because of science, I'm turning back to religion, or deism at least, what he ascribes to, or he's now passed away. So what he said was basically, science spotlights three dimensions of nature that point to God. The first is the fact that nature obeys laws, right? Why is there order instead of disorder? The second is the dimension of life, of intelligently organized and purpose-driven beings which arose from matter, right? We recognize that. And the third is the very existence of nature. The very existence of the universe is pointing to a God, is what he says. And here's somebody who's saying this, coming from an atheistic point of view. What is striking is, you all may know this, look at what the Bible says, right? The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands, Psalm 19. So what Anthony Flew is saying, all of this stuff was written thousands of years ago, right? And in Romans chapter 1, Paul writes, and he says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, that is his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. So basically, again, the creation declares the power, majesty, ability of God. And so what folks have been looking at it now, trying to figure out, and then kind of strugglingly, you know, refusingly coming to the point of saying, well, okay, I think I agree that there is a creator, has been the basis of our declared faith from the beginning. And this is Revelation, right? So if you look at that, God himself is saying, if you believe this is Revelation, right? And let's say you're not come to that belief yet, but let's just assume that you would agree that this religious scripture, Bible, is a revelation from God. If that is the case, then God is saying, well, here's my case for you. Look at what I've made, right? This is declaring my majesty, declaring my power. Look at that. Just look at what I've made. Try to make it again. And the book of Job, there is a series of conversations there which are even more powerful, which we don't have time to go into today at this point, right? So again, say the same thing. Make what I have made. Make it and show it to me. Then you come back and question my existence, right? Well, we haven't been able to get there yet. So if God is the reason for existence, then there are a couple of options, right? Deism, God created the universe but doesn't intervene, right? There's a deistic approach. It's like, okay, whatever, I made it up, I've set it in motion, I'm this force that keeps everything together, but that's about it, I don't really care about what's going on. And many, many atheists who have now come to an acceptance of a creator are happy to be here because it doesn't tell them how to live their lives, right? So the other side is theism. God is personally interested in the universe, right? And he created it, and he wants to be involved, and there is an intention to be involved, and expectation from creation in response. And if that is true, then you have to figure out which of these two you want to believe in, which of these two is right. And so what is God's interest is the next logical question, right? Of course, the moment you ask this question, you're back in this area. That's exactly where I started off, right? I'm back to square one. After all of that, I came back to square one. Now I've got to deal with Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, Judaism. So I started going down that path. It took me about 10 years to figure out, you know, I tried, and we don't have time to go into all of that today. But it's very important to think about each of these sources, each of their claims, what is foundational in those claims, what did they state, what did they show, and what's the proof they provide in support of the claims, right? Because that will tell you which claim to believe in. And that's the process that is required if you're coming from here. If you come, start from here, you go down this path, and now you say, I don't know which one is right, I've got to, the only way is test them all. If I don't, then I'm just going back to my favorite tradition that I grew up in. So I was like, well, I already know about Hinduism. I did quite a bit of work on that already. So I started there, so I stepped out of that, and I went into Buddhism for a good while. This is the closest one to me. I spent a lot of time there. I spent time in Islam because my close friends were Muslims. I knew quite a bit of the Quran and the hadith there. So I spent some time there in Islam. My grandmother gave me a Bible, 1998. She was a Hindu, of course, a devout Hindu. She knew I was doing all of the searching, and she said, well, you know, you may want to try something else as well. So she said, well, here's one that you don't have in your collection right now. And she gave me my first Bible. And so I started reading the Bible, and I was, and we'll talk about that later on. Nonetheless, I spent quite a bit of time trying to compare and understand from a foundational perspective, not from a comparative religious perspective. A lot of people do that, you know, comparing religions, you know, this is tradition, one tradition to how similar they are, what's their overlap, what's their differences. No, I was asking a simpler question. I said, well, you know, give me your scripture, whatever it is that you're claiming is yours. Give it to me. Walk me through it. Help me understand its basis. Tell me what the supporting evidence is, and then we'll move forward. And I got a lot of help along the way, of course. A lot of people helped me. We'll talk primarily today in this setting, we'll talk mainly about the Bible, and we can. I'm happy to address the other pieces offline with you if you're interested, the other religions. The Bible claims that God created the heavens and the earth. That's the very first thing you will see when you open the Bible, right? If you never open the Bible, you open it, page one, that's what you go to. Like in any other scripture, you say, okay, what's page one? Verse one, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, that's pretty powerful, huh? Comes out swinging, right? So, and then you keep reading. God created our life and made us in his own image, and it keeps going, 26 to 31. You know, I'll read a little bit of that, but I think it's worthwhile for those who have not read this piece. Then God said, let us make man in our own image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish and of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Let's see. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. There was evening and there was morning the sixth day. And that's how that ends. That piece of the earth. So if you read the very first chapter of the Bible, the Genesis chapter, you come across that God is the person who is creating everything. Everything that you can see, your eyes can see, he talks about earlier, we didn't have time to read it. Talks about the heavens, the stars, the moon. Everything was created by God. Well, that's how we started off, right? If God created all of existence, well, there you go. At least it's not saying something completely different. So it's worthwhile exploring a little bit further into this scripture and see what it means, right? Because it's at least fitting what we know, what we came to know from all of our philosophical mumbo-jumbo that we talked about in the first 30 minutes, right? So at least it's not discordant with that. So like, okay, we can continue reading. But it goes on, right? It goes on and says in John chapter 14, and that's really leading to our next lesson, John chapter 14, verse 8, it says, Philip, one of the disciples of Jesus, says to him, he says, Lord, show us the Father, that is God, the Father, and it is enough for us. And Jesus says to him, have I been with you so long, and you will not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me? Right? So these are challenges that Jesus posed to his disciples and he poses to us. So if the Bible claims that God created the heavens and the earth, God is the author of all creation, and God is completely embodied, the fullness of Godhead is embodied in Jesus, then it's time for us to explore the claims of Jesus. What did he say? Who is he? What did he do? What's the basis of this claim? Because this is a pretty big claim, right? So it's important that we explore it. So in part two, we will talk about exploring or evaluating the key claims of Jesus Christ, right? What has he said? What does the Bible say about him? And the Gospels say about him? And we'll talk about that a little bit. So with the idea that we can encourage you to open this scripture or this book, the Bible, and read it and see, come to your own conclusions as to what it says and what it means and what evidence there is to support its claims, specifically Jesus Christ and his claims, right? So we'll talk about that later. Thank you for your attention.